The Guardian.
The Guardian Books Podcast with Claire Armistead.
Greatest thing about Charles Dickens is the hugeness of the story, and he puts in so much, and the characters are just so wonderful.
So this is Colin Thuban talking about Dickens, or trying to. I think my favourite novel would be Great Expectations, because as a very young man it opened my eyes to the sheer exuberance of language.
My father's family name being Pirrip, and my Christian name Philip, my infant tongue could make of both names nothing longer or more explicit than Pip.
My name is Alan Bissett, and my favourite Dickens novel is Hard Times, partly because it's short, and partly because as a younger reader it had a really easily graspable theme, which is the difference between facts and forced education and creativity. That appealed to me at the time. Grad grind and his facts was exactly the opposite of the sort of person I wanted to be. So I can remember that forming part of my character when I was younger, because I was a dreamer, and Hard Times is that kind of book.
I'm Mallory Blackman, and my favourite Charles Dickens book is Oliver Twist. We first read it when I was at school, and I loved the story because, for once, it wasn't about gentry as such. It was about an ordinary boy and what it's like to be really poor in Victorian England.
He had often heard the old men in the workhouse say that no lad of spirit need want in London, and that there were ways of living in the vast city which those who had been bred up in country parts had no idea of. It was the very place for a homeless boy, who must die in the streets unless someone helped him.
Charles Dickens is about to be 200. Well, strictly speaking, his 200th birthday falls in February 2012, but we've decided to start the celebrations early as part of our autumn book season. So let's start here in the studio with Simon Winder from Penguin Classics, who are republishing the novels in gorgeous cloth-bound editions. And on the phone is one of their authors, Claire Tomlin, who's just written a biography of the great man. Claire, welcome.
Hello, hello. Hi.
Many years ago, you wrote The Invisible Woman about his relationship with the young Nellie Ternan. What made you revisit him?
Well, I've always been interested in Dickens since childhood. And I loved researching for The Invisible Woman. But I was well aware that he was only just a sort of bit part in that book. And when I was writing it, the poet and publisher, Dennis Enright, said to me, "Why on earth are you writing about Ternan? Why aren't you writing about Dickens?" And that sort of stayed in my mind. So I thought, when I saw a little bit of time empty ahead of me 5 years ago, I thought, oh, now perhaps I could take on Dickens.
You make quite an interesting decision about the opening of the book. So you don't begin it with his conception or his birth or anything. You begin with a courtroom scene.
I begin in the middle of his life because I feel in biography it's a bit of a hard bit to get over for many readers, you know, the ancestors, the birth, the childhood. And I rather wanted to introduce him to the readers as a fully-fledged person, the inimitable, this amazing, truly amazing, extraordinary man. And so I went in to one episode in 1840 and then sort of tried to give an introduction to him so that people had that to travel with through the book as a sort of point of reference. It also, that particular episode of him going to an inquest in a workhouse, the servant girl is accused of infanticide, shows Dickens at his very best. He was incredibly busy at the time, and he was determined to save her from being likely to get the death penalty, and he went in to bat for her. And not only that, so they got her off. She wasn't accused of murdering the baby, but she still had to go on to prison and be tried at the Old Bailey. And he actually hired a very distinguished lawyer, barrister, to defend her. And it's such a strange thing for a man of 28, I think he was then, with a family just starting up a new magazine, with so much to do, that he stopped and really did all that for one girl in whom he had no interest at all, except that he was always interested in the vulnerable and the lowest members of society and the people who came out of the cracks and crevices in the workhouses.
Now, Simon pointed out the lovely way he described the baby, Simon.
Yes, is that sort of like wonderful mixture of grossness and charm where he says how he can't help himself from thinking for a second that it's a sort of giant's lunch, like the corpse of the baby. And it's sort of like, I think that your use of that quote just sort of sums up the sort of strange tension inside Dickens, that he can't help himself in some ways.
The surgeon's knife is beside the body of the baby because the baby has been opened up and then sewn up again. So it's, you know, even more. I can remember thinking of my own first baby who was born in October, and we were obsessed with birth weights of babies. And when Christmas came, the turkeys were terribly like the babies.
That is a very Dickensian image from you too. Now, I want to talk a bit more about Nellie. You're very clear in this book that she had a baby by Dickens. That's your surmise, isn't it?
And no, it's not my surmise. It was said by two of Dickens's most intelligent children. They testified, Katie and Henry. Lots of people don't like this idea.
So Peter Ackroyd, for example, they says that relationship was chaste, doesn't he? Or
he
did.
It's impossible to imagine that it was a consummated one. I think it depends on how far your imagination stretches, you know.
Is this a new piece of information?
No, it's been around since for a very long time. Gladys Story published a book with information given her by Katie Dickens, by Dickens's very intelligent and wonderful daughter, whom he called Lucifer Box when she was a child because she was always firing up like a match in a matchbox. And she lived well on into the 20s, and she was determined to tell the truth about her father. And then Gladys Story went off and checked with Henry, who by then was Sir Henry Dickens, a lawyer of great distinction, and he confirmed there was a boy and he died.
She was away in France at that point, wasn't she?
Well, we don't know that. We don't know where she was. But I think if you look at all the letters and all the evidence there is, it seems that that's where she was, yes. Mm-hmm.
Partly why I brought that up is because I've been chatting with people on Twitter about this for the last couple of days. And I've got a couple of questions which have come on in from people. And someone called Isabel Gray asks, did you end up liking Dickens after the way he behaved to the women in his life?
Well, of course, that is a fundamental question. Dickens was an extraordinarily good man, and he behaved like a terrible villain in relation to his wife. I don't think he behaved particularly badly to other women in his life, but he did the classic banal thing of the middle-aged husband who falls in love with a young girl, and he did all the sort of worst things that men do when that happens, like wishing to justify themselves, wishing to appear to be in the right, suggesting that their wives were slightly mentally disturbed. I mean, the list of things he did, which was horrible, could be repeated over and over again when this banal situation occurs. Mm-hmm. It's deplorable. And I mean, I say in my book, I think that I want to avert my eyes from some of his behaviour at that time.
Mm-hmm. Do you take a more benign view, Simon?
No, I think he lets down half the human race at that point. It really is a terrible moment. I mean, it's that strange feeling with Dickens that he's shooting off like a Catherine wheel on all these different, his interest in so many different things and at so many different levels in so many different ways. And you think he's this sort of Superman, and then suddenly turns out he's actually like pathetically usual in his actions.
Now, I've got another question for both of you from Sam Kershaw, and this is a controversial one. Why has Dickens' reputation soared and Thackeray's diminished, although the latter is clearly the better writer? Do we agree with this?
It is curious, except that I think Thackeray wrote one book, which is possibly the greatest English novel of the 19th century, which is Vanity Fair. But the rest of Thackeray's writing simply doesn't match up to it.
But a lot of Dickens is quite rough and ready, isn't it, Simon?
Yes, but nothing's as bad as The Newcomes, I don't think. I mean, you know, I recently read Barry Lyndon, and you know, it's moderately enjoyable, but it is, I'd rather do pretty much anything else. I mean, I think, you know, there is this one great book. I don't think you need to choose, though. I think this idea that somehow there's a league table, I think it's just different moods, isn't it, really?
Yeah, I think that's right, yes.
Yes.
And Dickens's failing is ham. I mean, he had this great love of the theatre. So you get this terrible dialogue occasionally, particularly from women, and particularly from fallen women, as they were known, who sort of beat their breasts and express terrible remorse and say they're going to throw themselves into the river. That's straight out of 19th century cheap melodrama in the theatre.
And those awful bits where he turns to the reader directly and says, "Oh, ye good gentlemen, you know, asleep in your beds in England, think of the fallen woman." It's just
absolutely, really,
it's just excruciating.
But it sort of doesn't matter. Because
no, even
the books which have extended passages that aren't so good, in each book he creates a world. And you are, if you surrender to it, he leads you through this world. And it is an extraordinary experience.
Is he a great writer, or is he just a very popular one?
Is he a great writer? Yes, he is a great writer. Only Shakespeare and Chaucer created characters, you know, who are unforgettable in English literature, and then Dickens does it.
One of the greatest. I mean, I just finished rereading Barnaby Rudge, which is a pretty rough patch for many people, but it's worth persevering. There's page after page of terrible fustian, and there's this awful character called Dolly Varden, who is like very low on the list of worst figures in English literature because it's simply so banal. But you know that you're going to get your payoff, because about halfway through he sets fire to London, and it's just the most marvellous stuff with the most fantastic villains, and it's just more vivid and better than anyone else, really.
And also there's this extraordinarily modern and original idea of having your hero somebody mentally handicapped.
Yes.
I mean, it's a really weird thing to have done.
Well, it's strange. Just by chance, last week I was reading Beckett's The Expelled, which is just like an astounding, I think, piece of short prose. But it is absolutely Dickensian in every way. It seems a spin-off from Dickens, almost. It's no more frightening and it's no more disturbing than Quilp, say, or whatever. You know, the ability to conjure up these extraordinary villains, this sort of zoo of monsters which he's able to create, I think really makes everyone else look rather pallid.
Yes, Quilp, the villains and Squeers are absolutely incomparable. I mean, it makes you think of Keats, you know, who said that Shakespeare delighted in the Iago as much as an Imogen. Dickens clearly delighted in his villains.
Yes, there's always this rather banal point about how his heroes tend to be a bit insipid, but I'm not quite sure how they could compete. You know, that it's not fair. It's not a fair race between Quilp and anyone else.
Claire, I'm going to just stop this discussion here. I hope that we'll have lots more discussion around this sort of area over the next few weeks. But I want to ask you one last question before we let you go, Claire, which is from, it's another Twitter question. It's from Paul Blizzard. And it's, given your extensive research, is there a burning unanswered question you would ask if you could have 5 minutes with Charles Dickens?
Well, I'd ask him what happened to the letters he wrote to Nellie Ternan. Because I think those letters have been destroyed. But I think if we had those letters, they would give us, I mean, Dickens was an amazing letter writer. They would give us another voice of Dickens, and they would illuminate a very large area of his later life in a way that would be completely fascinating.
Oh, that's brilliant. Well, I will let you get off back to your publicity tour now. Oh,
thank you very much.
Which is positively Dickensian in its energy. And now, of course, there is also a Dickens Museum here in central London, where I met up with the director, Florian Schweitzer.
We go into the hall and there are lots of letters.
Letters from Dickens. Look at his handwriting. It's with this extraordinary signature he had, with loads and loads and loads and loads of underlines and very long and narrow, all with Doughty Street at the top.
If you'd like to follow me upstairs. Yeah, we've got some treasures here. There's a copy of Dickens' biography that was owned by John Irving, the 19th century actor. We've got some first editions, some presentation copies. So we're now going through the new part of the museum that will become the Visitor and Learning Centre. Still smells of fresh paint because we're just about to get this ready for the bicentenary. So it's the first time in 86 years that it is being used for the museum. So really this is part of our Great Expectations project. This would have been the drawing room that the family would have withdrawn to after dinner, Dickens with his friends, although this is of course the adjacent building. So Dickens' house was number 48 Doughty Street, and this new part of the museum is the number 49. He lived here from 1837 to 1839 while writing Pickwick Papers, Oliver Twist and Nicholas Nickleby. So very productive, but a very short time. He then moved to other bigger properties as his family grew and later bought a house in Kent. The story we want to tell with those letters downstairs in the hallway was his day-to-day life here at Doughty Street. So some deal with books that his friends picked up from here to take to publishers. There are some where he talks about the horses. One he refers to the miscarriage that his wife had while they lived here. So really Dickens the man at Doughty Street, because we've got quite a large number of letters written from here. And therefore, we can really kind of understand what life was like for Dickens and the business concerns, the writing pressures that he had, but also just the man inviting people over for a chop of lamb or something.
So now we've got a real treat, which, and they're very different sort of books to look at than the books that are in the bookshelves downstairs. They are look very pristine. They have beautiful watermarked bindings, leather and gold tooled, and we're putting on rather garish purple surgical gloves to handle them. Are these very precious? Will, if I touch them with bare hands, will they fall to dust?
They won't fall to dust because we've looked well after them for the last 140 years, or the museum for the last 70 years. They are very important to our collection. There are only 12 of these copies in the world. There are 6 here at Doughty Street and another 6 at the New York Public Library. They were Dickens' own personal reading copies that he created for the readings from his own works. In 1851, Charles Dickens started giving public readings for charity initially. He raised money for children's hospitals and other charities and charitable activities around the country. So what he did, he took some of his most popular stories, particularly Christmas Carol, and started reading them. And what he did with those special copies, he actually had them reprinted for his own reading, so that he would have his own reading copy, which would be bound, as he described, beautifully bound. And he would take them onto the stage. Initially would have read from them, but later on he knew the text by heart so well, and he was really an actor at heart, and then started modifying the text by actually erasing certain areas, and he marked those up, as you can see here, in blue and black ink.
And you can see the same handwriting that we see in the letters downstairs.
Yes, yeah. So this was really his prompt copy, and he would look at it and he would say, right, okay, I'm going to delete half of this page. Of course, this wasn't something that he could have typed on his PC, and therefore all the sort of text changes are visible. And because he read them in very large halls, he had to also be very economic about it, because without kind of PA system, he couldn't really project too far, and therefore he had to be very economic with his voice. I think there's also one that says sigh. So it was really something that he enjoyed as well. I think he really loved working on these wonderful books.
I'm Andrew O'Hagan, the novelist. I have to say that I go back again and again, not just at Christmas, but I think at different stages of my life, to the beauty of A Christmas Carol, Charles Dickens's, in some ways, most philosophically quiet book, but one in which he allows us to examine the meaning of the present in relation to the past and the future in a really beautiful way.
Marley was dead to begin with. Old Marley was as dead as a doornail. Mind, I don't mean to say that I know of my own knowledge what there is particularly dead about a doornail. I might have been inclined myself to regard a coffin nail as the deadest piece of ironmongery in the trade, and even Scrooge was not so dreadfully cut up by the sad event, but that he was an excellent man of business on the very day of the funeral, and solemnized it with an undoubted bargain.
Now, that museum's being refurbished for the celebrations, Simon, but it's really quite a small representation of Dickens' huge body of work, isn't it?
Yes, I think it's very hard to know, I mean, how to represent it, really. I mean, the real representation is in the books, but otherwise everything's scattered to the four winds, really, and there's bits everywhere.
Claire mentioned earlier that she mentioned him in the same breath as Shakespeare. Is he up there with Shakespeare?
Oh, definitely, definitely. It might be. You know, Shakespeare maybe comes down a peg or two and Dickens goes up a peg or two.
Oh, I mean, that is controversial.
Controversial. But I think I was really struck, I was looking at these Victorian pictures of favourite characters from Dickens, and it's amazing the way that they sentimentalise these figures. And so you have people like Uriah Heep or Wackford Squeers or Quilp, seen almost as rather jolly little sprites in some way. And that kind of nurseryfication of Dickens is so strange, because they are the most extraordinarily evil figures, effectively as evil as anything in Shakespeare. And yet a great deal of effort has gone in over the years to the idea that somehow they're domesticated or sort of charming in some way rather than appalling. I mean, he has, like, Quilp at some point in the old curiosity shop drinks boiling alcohol, or Dickens mucks around making him make journeys which humans couldn't do. He's there to face-to-face with little Nell in situations where you know he can't have travelled that fast. But Dickens doesn't care because he's not creating a human being, he's creating a demon. And this is true throughout the books, I think. There's this sense of just restless wickedness, which comes across now, I think, as very modern. And as long as you forget that kind of childhood nursery poster aspect to it, there's a kind of rawness and the sense of the very high stakes in the books, which I think makes them incredibly major.
Are they internationally as popular as Shakespeare?
I think, yes. I mean, they've always been widely read, I think, certainly across Europe. In America, it was funny because, obviously in America, the cult of Dickens has always been absolutely enormous. But he kind of blotted his copybook somewhat with Martin Chuzzlewit, which I was also rereading recently, which is has this fantastically satirical section set in America, which alienated many of the readers who loved the old curiosity shop. And it is very funny. I mean, it's incredibly crude and cruel, but it is a funny representation of a particular form of American boosterism. But I mean, that shook off some of his American readers. But nonetheless, no, I think he's a global figure. I mean, Shakespeare has become a kind of strange kind of currency, I suppose. And he has his own life in different languages, which maybe is not so true of Dickens. I mean, so much perhaps of the great value lies in his choice of words.
I heard a lovely story about China. Apparently, I don't know whether you know this, Bleak House was one of the few novels that weren't banned in China because they thought that it gave such a bad picture of England covered in fog that it was it would never encourage anyone to go there.
No, well, I'm sure that's right. I'm sure that they have their uses. The idea of a picture of a nation of imperialist running dogs is you could definitely get that out of them.
Well, thanks very much for coming in, Simon.
You're very
and
welcome.
Also for the use of a couple of your Dickens audiobooks with wonderful readers. And we heard Hugh Laurie earlier. And next up is Ronald Pickup.
My name's Ian Rankin. My favourite Dickens is got to be Bleak House. It was the first book of his I read. I read it at university, and it was terrific. It's a hugely entertaining, convoluted crime novel, which happens to be about contemporary England, the contemporary England of Dickens's time. Has a huge and extraordinary cast of three-dimensional characters, has some social conscience in there. I've read it probably half a dozen times since I left university, and every time it's with a great seething feeling of jealousy that I can't write a book like that.
London. Michaelmas term lately over, and the Lord Chancellor sitting in Lincoln's Inn Hall. Implacable November weather. As much mud in the streets as if the waters had but newly retired from the face of the earth, and it would not be wonderful to meet a megalosaurus 40 feet long or so, waddling like an elephantine lizard up Holborn Hill. Fog everywhere. And hard by Temple Bar, in Lincoln's Inn Hall, at the very heart of the fog, sits the Lord High Chancellor in his High Court of Chancery.
You might feel that we've done with Dickens, but you'd be wrong. There's going to be lots more of him in the months to come. Lindsay Irving from the Books Desk is here now to fill us in.
One thing to look out for is our special Dickens audio tour. It's the first of three, and this one will guide you through London's Clerkenwell in the footsteps of Fagin and Oliver Twist, enabling you to hear the River Fleet running beneath the streets of London as you imagine what the rookeries would have looked like, which are one of the notorious Victorian slums which stood on the spot of the old Guardian offices in Farringdon Road.
That'll be on guardian.co.uk from Sunday, where you can download it to play on your iPod as you follow the trail. You can also just enjoy it on your computer, where you can also subscribe to our podcast, either on iTunes or by going to guardian.co.uk/books and clicking on the podcast button at the top of the page. Other things to look forward to in the coming week include, you guessed it, more Dickens.
Yeah, we've got an extract from Claire Tomlin's biography of the great man in Saturday Review. And following that on Sunday, there'll be an interview with her in the Observer New Review. On Saturday, we're also running our list of the 100 most powerful people in publishing. We'll find out what people make of that on the podcast next week.
And of course, our book swap continues. I haven't yet heard from the person who found Bobby Baker's diary drawings, which I left at Bromley by Bow, but it did go, and I live in hope. Please get in touch if you are the lucky person who found it. Many thanks to Simon Winder, Claire Tomlin, Lindsay Irving, and to our producer, Tim Mabey. I'm Claire Armistead. Thanks for listening. Goodbye.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.